Our first 10-minute speaker is James.
Hey, I'm James. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not going to lie. It's really hot down here in a suit. This is not a lot of fun. But it's good to be here. My sponsor was reminding me yesterday that I should really focus tonight on talking about like the definition of alcoholism and what it means in my life. But he's not here, so I'm going to talk about my work problems for 10 minutes. No, I'm really kidding. I mean, that was a canned joke I just set up 10 seconds ago. And I really am kidding, because like really none of that stuff matters. It isn't a big book to talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I am like now, because those are really the only things I'm prepared to talk about, and that's really the only thing that matters. I have nothing to say about my childhood, because my childhood was good. I grew up a few blocks from here, like literally three blocks. Like, I've been in this church many times before I got sober. It was actually kind of heartbreaking when I got here and realized that this is where I was going to spend the rest of my life, and I'm like, I've lived my whole life to go so, like, such little distance. And then I moved away and I realized, actually, I'd rather be here than anywhere else. But, I grew up in a good family, good house, had everything I ever needed, most of what I wanted. And I was really, really miserable. I fundamentally lack the ability to cope with life. Just, like, talking to anyone, my parents, my sister, teachers, people at school, like, the world around me was just overwhelming, and I was so miserable from such a young age. And I hear people talk about, you know, the spiritual malady, this hole in their heart that just, like, sucks all the joy out of life, and I had that so bad long before I ever got sober. Like, when I first came in, they said, like, alcohol is not my problem, it's my solution, and I don't think I'd ever related to anything in my life more than that. Like, that for the first time, like, someone actually understood my perspective. And so when I was 15, I guess, I went on a school trip with a chaperone, who I can't say if he was an alcoholic. I can just say he was fired for being high in school. Like, that's just a fact. I was drunk the entire 2 weeks. Other countries don't enforce their drinking laws as much as America does. And it was great. Like, for the first time in my life, like, I felt relief. Like, I could relate to these people that were older than me. I didn't feel so insecure in my own skin. I had fun. I was the life of the party. People wanted to hang out. And I did not, you know, at that point, it wasn't, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say I was experiencing the phenomenon of craving. I wouldn't, seven times on that trip that I blacked out. But, you know, I came back to New York, and I did not want the party to stop. And if you're 15, 16 in New York City, there are a lot of other things that are easier to get than alcohol. Basically anything, actually. Alcohol is the hardest thing to get if you're a teenager in New York these days. I did a lot of drugs, and I'll leave it at that. But, you know, suffice to say, like, my problem is drinking, but my problem is that I cannot deal with life, and I find relief from numbing out. Like, any substance that takes me completely out of myself brings me relief, because I just can't deal with life. Like, that is my problem. I find relief from alcohol. Even when I try not to start, I can't help myself, and once I start, I can't stop. And, like, I would, you know, I'd spend the next few years constantly telling myself I need to stop. Like, I can't do this. Like, I can't live this way. Or at the very least, I need to stop for, like, 2 hours, because I've got a college interview. And, you know, just find myself completely, completely incapable of that fact, right? Like, I can't stop myself from starting. And so I somehow, like, stumbled my way into college, like, somewhat literally, and I joined a fraternity for no reason other than to drink. And I drank too much, so they asked me to leave. And it was really after just a few months. Like, they were very, very concerned about my behavior. I had, you know, acquaintances at college who sold things other than alcohol, who were texting me quite concerned. So eventually I got sent to a psych ward. I got sent to a psych ward. I'd been seeing a psychiatrist off and on since high school, and I just got so unstable that they like, you, we can, like, 5150 you, like, involuntarily commit you, or you can just commit yourself. So I mean, I figured I'd like dodge the like mandatory 2 weeks or whatever and commit myself. And then I got into the psych ward, and I ended up having to sedate and restrain me for a few days. And like my image of myself inside was always just this like nice Jewish guy from the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and I'm like strapped to a gurney, and they're like forcing benzos down my throat to knock me unconscious, and I'm like, how am I here? Like the guy next door to me is schizophrenic, and like they're clearly worried about me. So I'm gonna speed up because I'm probably telling too many jokes, but you know, basically they're like, you can stay in the psych ward or you can go to rehab, and I went to rehab. And I mean, a bunch of crazy stuff happened in rehab. I left rehab at one point, and I spent a night in a homeless shelter in Utah. So, hey, it wasn't so bad. It was a lot nicer than they are here. And but eventually, I just came to a realization that like I wanted, you know, I just wanted to not live the life I've been living anymore. You know, I felt like such a loser. And the honest truth was like, I didn't have a lot going on. You know, my life was not very big or fun. No one really liked me. I kind of smelled. The whole like basic hygiene had kind of gone out the window, you know, and I just didn't want to live that life anymore. You know, I needed to change, and then eventually I kind of was like, oh wait, that means I need to stop drinking. And I came back to New York, and I started going to meetings, and I was still very defiant. I was very angry. I knew I had to stop drinking, but I didn't really know like what that like looked like, and I kind of thought I could do it on my own. And eventually that didn't work. There's a lot in the book, beaten into a state of reasonableness by alcohol. Like, I was still pretty unreasonable just from alcohol, but like the sheer misery of like untreated alcoholism, that finally beat me into a state of reasonableness. So I got a sponsor, and I started going through the steps, and this just like deep well of like inexplicable anger that I had just been carrying around with me my whole life like started to fade away. And people here are like, and for the first time in my life, like, people wanted me around. Like, I used to go to the Monday 79-Street workshop every week, and a somewhat curmudgeonly member of this group named Ron would take me out for dinner every week. And, like, you know, like, for someone who'd just been so alone for so long, and this, like, 18-year-old, 19-year-old, 20, however old I was, completely out of his mind, college student, to have people actually, like, want you around, you know, it was nice. You know, I wanted to stay here. That, like, really, really helped me. You know, and I went through the steps, I got commitments, and, you know, my life today is fundamentally, like, completely unrecognizable. For one thing, I've had the same job for 2.5 years. And I once quit a job after 2 days. Like, I've like, beaten my previous record by, like, 400 times. You know, and, like, the things that, like, I was taught to do here, like, just show up, be a nice guy, try and help others, pay attention. It got me through college, it got me through the workplace, and it's, you know, and I mean, beyond that, like, just, like, the relationships I have with other people today, like, particularly, like, my family, is amazing. I talk to my dad, like, every other hour, which may be too much, but, like, we're very close. You know, and, like, my parents did not want to even, like, see me at one point. My sister and I don't always get along, but she lives in L.A., and I, like, went there, and I flew out, and I visited her, which even my parents didn't do, so I was, like, gloating about that for a while, that I'm a better brother than they are parents, but, you know, I'm not perfect. I still want to, the few things in my life I can remain to get egotistical about, I still want to, but, you know, just, like, the fact that I can actually have and maintain relationships with other people in my life today, it's just, like, revolutionary, because I could not before, you know, if nothing else, just, I was just so crushingly alone, and I really don't have that in my life today. How much time do I have? Like, a minute? Okay, so, I mean, I guess just in the remaining 60 seconds I have left, you know, I talked about, like, what I'm like today. You know, I've been sober since April 1st, 2014, so almost 6 years, I guess. Thank you. You know, in that time, I've gone to college, finished college, moved out of New York, realized I hate California, moved back to New York. New York's way better. You know, sponsored guys, not sponsored guys, hasn't always like had a happy sobriety. You know, I've had stretches of deep resentment and frustration that I have to be here. But you know, at least today, I go to meetings. I have a service commitment. You know, I call my sponsor on a daily basis. And if you need a sponsor, I don't have that much going on. I'm available. So thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Angela.
Hi, thanks. Angela, alcoholic. Hi, guys. So, yeah, there's a lot of folks, so I'm going to get a little more nervous than a little before. But we'll put the nerves aside. We'll just let the good Lord help me, since he's helped me so many times. Well, we can start with when my sobriety date is January 18th, 2018. So I got 2 years and a month. Never thought that would ever happen. My family life growing up, well, it was Italian, Catholic, dysfunctional. Everyone smoked cigarettes. Everyone drank alcohol. And that's all I wanted to do. I wanted to be like them. So I snuck my first few drinks when I was 5, 6. Nothing really to write home about. But, you know, I started smoking cigarettes at 8 years old. So that kind of just... And through all this, there was reasons I'm learning now through the program that I was a shy kid. I was a really shy kid. And that made me sad. I never felt like I fit in. I got depressed, and it just got worse. The cigarettes, I was a professional smoker by the age of 10. I was good. I was inhaling. I was holding them. I was slick. I was killing myself. Anyway, then we got into, you know, the Boone's Farm apple wine back then. We all loved that stuff. My first concert. You know, and they're passing around the smoking, and, you know, and there I was. I went off. I just never stopped. And drinking always was part of my story. Substances, of course, very involved. In the 80s, those were my years. The 80s, I was great. I wasn't great in what I was doing, but I was great. You know, I was having fun. It was good. But little did I know that it was just getting worse. And I was poisoning myself more and more. And then high school was a blur. Can't tell you about high school. I know the name. And the year I graduated, because I was 18, and then I was able to drink, so then I was legit. I was good. And then my world started falling apart. When I was 21, we had friends. Again, substances. Bad. Drinking after the substances. My life just became... It was really nothing. It was really nothing. That's all through my 20s, my 30s, my 40s. It just went on for life. I felt like it was just going to be part of my life. I was going to die this way, and I was going to die happy with alcohol, and that was what it was going to be. So we get through the 30s and the 40s, and I have children, and I stayed straight for a while, but no sooner, they were big enough, I was out doing what I do best. Again, there was really no consequences at that point, because everybody must have been blind to my addiction, because no one ever came up to me and said, hey, you know, you're going a little overboard, what are you doing? I was 99 pounds, soaking wet. I wasn't myself, but I fooled everyone. I fooled them. I got 17 years out of fooling people until my first rehab in 97. And that's when I was introduced to AA, and AA became a part of my life in my brain. I couldn't physically go to AA because I still had business to take care of. I had unleft business to take care of. So, but that... that first rehab, I relapsed. So my story is another rehab, relapsed. So 5 rehabs later, couldn't get the message. 20 years now from 97, 20 years, I still never stopped. What happened? Well, my children kind of like left me. They were embarrassed to be around me. They didn't want me to pick them up at school. They kind of knew what my deal was, and they were embarrassed. It got to the point where they just started disrespecting, but I was always tough, so they couldn't disrespect that much. They still had some left. And I promised one day I would do it for myself, but for my children, because they didn't need to see this. So we got, let's see, 5 rehabs, 2 arrests, laying in the jails, on the mats. Like, who thought my life would end up? My husband bailed me out. How he didn't. He's a good man. He's just a good man. He never threw me out. He always gave me hope to just get better. But it didn't work for this alcoholic. This person was very sick. So, and then consequences, my family in Montauk, I never got invited to any functions because I would leave parties, the last one, with a drink in my hand all the time, which was kind of embarrassing for my husband. So he finally started beefing it up and saying, look, you need to calm down. Something's going on. But that was just hearsay because I still continued. Still in that 20-year period of being introduced to AA again, in 2018, which is my sobriety, January 18th, 2018, and I heard a message from a sober coach who I love, and for some reason on that day, I mean, I had heard this before, but on that day, she said to me, Angela, you just have to grow up. And I don't know, at first I felt bad, like, how dare you tell me I'm not grown up, because I'm grown up. Look at me, I'm 57, I'm good. No. But it resonated in my mind, and I kept that in my mind for a long time. Started going to meetings, met my sponsor, who is an angel, and works with me with such patience, and I do thank you, Elaine. You are the best, wherever you may be. So then we go into, you know, where it was. Once I got sober, life started changing, I became happier, and then we come across my year and a half, and then I got bad news, which if I was drinking, this bad news would have killed me. So I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. So they told me it wasn't terminal, so that was enough for me. That meant that I was going to get the surgery, the chemo, and all that. But even after all that, I never felt sorry for myself. I knew I was going to be all right, and I never picked up a drink. There was just no picking up the drink. The drink would have made it worse. I know that. So today, I am cancer-free. I have... Thanks. Thank you. And, you know, I'm living my life a day at a time, which is most important for me right now because the chemo's still going on. But, you know, God's got me. He's got to be the only one. Because prior to that, I had a stroke and a mild heart attack, all in 3-month radius. So if I wanted to drink, that would have been the time. But I didn't want to drink. There was no drinking for Angela anymore. She made a mess of her life. A lot. Everything. My family, my children. My husband is still with me. God bless him. But I'm also better. And he sees it. Everyone sees it. And such a nice harmony in the family. Nobody drinks now. So was it only because Angela used to bring out the booze? I don't know. But it's fine because, you know, I could picture myself walking into someone's house and saying, okay, let's start drinking. And no one really wanted to drink, but to keep me company, there was drinking. But now that I'm not drinking, I noticed that no one else in my family. The harmony and just getting along with each other. I used to fight one word and I would be off. And everybody would just look at me as, well, she's the drunk. This is what she does. But my life today, I am so grateful. I'm grateful for this past experience I went through. I had the stroke, no paralyzation, no residual. I was very, very lucky that I am able to stand here and speak to you standing. And it put some thoughts in my mind. It's time now to keep my faith. And my faith is my Lord, my God. And for Him, I owe everything to. And I'll be better through the years. Thank you.
Our main speaker is Clark. Hi, I'm Clark, and I'm an alcoholic. I was hoping for an off night, but not at the Atlantic Group. I think about recovery and the collective recovery in this room, and it's basically infinite. And, you know, it's infinite from the start of 85 years to now, and anything I say is, you know, just my story. But it's really great to be here. I never thought in a million years I'd be speaking at an AA meeting of this kind, because I never thought I'd be an AA. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And to be in a group like this with such a, you know, wonderful history and all the good work is really terrific. I'm happy to be here. And my experience, strength and hope. I drank for a long time, so I have a long story. I came into the rooms when I was 40. I'm 56 now. I had 16 years a couple of weeks ago, and I'm very excited about that. I'm the youngest of six children, so from an Irish Catholic family. I call that my hereditary handicap. And all that means, you know, people like to talk about their ancestry or their industry about we were really heavy drinkers, you know, and I do think the Irish still have a pretty good call on that claim. However, I'm sure there are Icelandic librarians that are pretty alcoholic. So, we're all in the right place. I started drinking when I was young because my siblings were older and I was around older people a lot. And the first time I drank, we were on a family trip with other families. So I was, I think, like 12, and there were a lot of kids around that were 17, 18, 19. I got my hands on alcohol. Everybody was doing whatever they were doing. I was drinking freely. That night I drank until I passed out. And that was my first experience with drinking. I had no off switch the first time I had alcohol. But I didn't know anything about it. I was young. It was irrelevant. You know, my parents laughed. My siblings laughed. So the second time was in high school, not too long after that. I played football. I'm from the South. I played football, and we were at a party, and a bunch of us got drunk. And somebody turned us in. And so we show up at practice, and the coach says, I want everybody that drank at that party to step forward. And so we were all standing at a line, and all of a sudden, you know, like one foot is like moving, and I stepped forward with about eight guys. And so we were called affectionately the Sunrise Services Club. We showed up at 6 a.m. for a week, and they ran us, you know, like ran us around the track as punishment. But of course, you know, I thought, well, this is good. It's going to help me get in shape. And I turned a negative into a positive, and part of my denial factor that was working quite well when I was younger. And all I did was continue the same pattern. I thought none of my drinking had consequences. So, you know, when I think about that, and I didn't really think about that, I started to see consequences late in my drinking, but early on, I wrecked two cars, and I thought, I have no problem. I didn't even associate alcohol with a problem of what happened. I was drunk both times. And I remember the second one, it was my dad's car. I pulled it in the driveway. It was late at night. I ran over a stop sign. And it ripped the bumper, and I got the car home, but the bumper was eating into the tire on my way home. And I went to bed, and I got up, and I went to my dad, and I said, I wrecked your car last night. And he said, well, yeah, I know. I've been out. I've seen it. And no major consequences, but one of my favorite drunk stories with cars, I was in a friend of mine's car, his father's car, and we were together, three of us, and we got drunk. It was a New Year's Eve. I was still maybe a little older than high school. So I'm the guy that's driving us all home at like 3 in the morning, and I passed my friend's street. He's asleep in the back of his dad's car. I'm driving. I have a good friend of mine on the pass in the passenger seat. We passed his street. The guy was like, "Oh, you just passed his street." So I hit reverse. I backed it straight into a tree. And then I looked at my friend who was not asleep. It's the guy asleep. It's his dad's car. I was like, "We should get out and leave him here." And, I mean, honestly, that was my best thinking. I was like, he'll have no idea. We didn't do that. But what we did is we took it home, and he went in, and my friend didn't know what happened, the guy whose dad's car it was. So he goes to bed. Their family is in chaos the next day. Who wrecked my dad? Who wrecked my car? I wasn't even there now. I just dropped him off and left. And so I didn't tell the guy for a year that it was me. So again, alcohol-related problems, just no clarification of what was going on. I kept sort of moving forward with a lot of the same results in that I went to college. The first day at college, I saw a flyer for a mixer with a girls' dorm. And I thought, this is great. These people really got it together. So I wanted to go buy olives and straws and mixers, right? It was a boy-girl mixer. I had no idea. I was like, this is a booze thing, right? And in my head, right? And so later that day, I went out for football, and I didn't like sort of how they did it. So I went over to the rugby team, and these guys were complete. This is my group. And so they ran a half a lap. A couple guys were smoking. We went out for drinks right away, and I knew I'd found my sport because you can basically do everything you want to do. And so I had an illustrious career of mayhem in college of playing rugby at different schools across the country. But, in college, again, I was doing enough to stay there, but what I was missing all along was I didn't know I wasn't comfortable. I didn't have any emotional depth. I didn't know myself. I thought, if you asked me how I was doing, I was happy or I was sad or I was good or I was bad. That was basically all I could give somebody because I didn't know myself. And so I was just trying to fit in. I wanted to be with people that I thought were somebody I wanted to be with. I mean, I didn't have enough knowledge of myself to say that I'm comfortable in who I am. And so I was always reaching to be with people that were doing something that I thought was interesting. And I never identified it as anything other than, they're having a good time. That's what I want to do. And so in college, I kept doing a lot of the same stuff. I got through it. I started working in New York in the summers, and I saw sort of a different side of how people live. I didn't know, the lifestyle in New York. I'd been here, but I moved here when I got out of school, and I started working on Wall Street. And early on in that career, I found similar people doing similar things. And so my first week on the job, their guy that ran the trading desk went to the college I went to, and the market closed at 4. And so at 4:01, we were walking out to a bar across the street where we'd drink 1,000 Budweisers until he thought it was time to go home. But, that was like 8 o'clock, right? Then I learned, what the next level of New York life was like. But if some nights we'd stop for the 1,000 beers and then he'd say, let's go get a nightcap at an Irish bar called Neary's. And Neary's is where he would start crying about things. and then I would start crying about things. But we didn't know what we were crying about. And still it was like 9:30 at night. And it just, but I was single. And I thought, I'm not harming anybody. And again, not associating drinking at all with what's going on in my life. And I was, being in New York in the sort of late 80s, It was pretty wild, and I thoroughly enjoyed that part. But it wasn't, you know, adding up in any esteemable acts, right? I mean, I didn't know I was starting to dig my bottom, really, you know, and I'm the only one in my family in recovery. I didn't know anything about recovery. I didn't know that it, really 12 steps existed. I had no idea what people were doing. And so, you know, if anybody talked that they didn't drink, I stopped talking to them. I mean, for sure. I went the other way. I was that guy. And so as I moved forward, you know, sort of sputtering around, I left and I went to business school, and that was fun because it was another chance to really have a good time while you were theoretically doing something interesting. But I was in Chicago, and I thoroughly loved that town. It was a great drinking town. They liked to drink beer and do shots, and that suited me fine. You know, going to Cubs games and not remembering leaving and just, you know, all the fun you can have. I mean, I did a lot of really interesting things that I have no memory of. I mean, it really sucks in some ways. Excuse me. So I moved back to New York after graduate school, and I met a woman, got married, and she drank like I did. That worked out well. We're still married, you know. Believe it or not, actually. I mean, it's a long story, probably longer than 30 minutes, but we've survived. We celebrate 26 years of marriage next on Thursday, 2 days. And that's only a gift of this room. I mean, I made every mistake to ruin that. And I'll get into a little of it. So I met my wife, and we have 3 kids. A daughter that's now 25, 23, daughter, and a 16-year-old son. I came in when my son was 1 month old, which is kind of cool. So I can measure my sobriety against his age. I mean, I'm a teenager in sobriety. More like dog years, but... So we got married, and all of a sudden that complicates sort of the fun part, right? I mean, that definitely puts a lot of more attention on your life and lifestyle, and that caused a lot of problems. And so as I thought... Listen, I'm a decent guy, okay? You're terrific. I'm a decent guy. But like 10% of the time, I want to do whatever I want to do. And you really don't have much to say about it. I never expressed it that way. Probably would have been helpful. But I just did it. And so I remember my wife said, this is classic, she said, you would lie when the truth would do. So, I mean, you know, where were you? I was at, you know, the restaurant. And, you know, the restaurant had closed a year ago or something. I mean, that was me. And I was like, that's my story. As I'm drinking, she parties, you know. And so we were, like, doing our thing. But then I was getting into the progressive side of alcoholism without knowing anything about it. So my alcoholism is really starting to take off. But I just think I'm doing what everybody else is doing. She likes to drink and have fun. So I started doing things that were, my bottom was, I was getting, the shovel was out. And so, like, episodically, I would go out. I was a heavy drinker with a proclivity to have binges. And so episodically, I would pull all-nighters, and I would go out, and I wouldn't come home. Now, it's a little cute every once in a while. It's a stretch. But it's not good for a marriage, especially when kids are involved. It would happen, and then I would be in the doghouse. And what I would do is go, when it would happen. Sometimes I planned it, but as I got deeper down my progressive disease, I couldn't plan it. But so what would happen is I'd go out, either a business thing or some function, and whatever, I'd have a drink. Drink would lead to another one, and any of my plans of being a good guy would be out the window. I couldn't control what would happen next. And so I would leave places. I had this sort of ability to pull what I called, you know, the Irish exit. And if, you know, I've sat with you at a dinner, I might excuse myself and not return. And I wouldn't say goodbye. And I couldn't tell you when that was going to happen. And so, you know, you leave. So I did this. Here's one that's kind of interesting. I'm sitting at a dinner with one of my best friends, who I actually helped get sober. He now has 10 years. And his wife and my wife, four of us, we're drunk as could be. Other things started to get involved, and my light went off. I got up with four people at the table. I got up and left. My wife, my best friend, his wife, I did not come back. They're looking for me. I'm like taking my batteries out of my phone so I can't be tracked. I mean, you know, it's completely insane. And I didn't know I had a problem. So what happened is that this proclivity to have binges started to really ramp up. And I know something changed in my drinking when I was 38. I don't know exactly when, but I knew at 38 I lost the ability to stop. I couldn't tell what night, but generally I couldn't stop if I started. And so I pulled an all-nighter. They started to really come. And so there was September of 2003, I had three of them in a four-week period. I think it was September, maybe August. So I'm in deep trouble at home. Like, this is really not good. I have two, my wife's pregnant, I have two little kids, two girls, six and a half, and eight and a half. And I'll do anything now to make this go away. So the idea of marriage counseling came up. So, like, sure, I need marriage counseling. Let's do that. So we go into this marriage counselor's office, and he says, you know, the classic, what are you guys doing here? Well, he's a jerk. He's, you know, stays out all night. He drinks a lot. And he looked at us and said, you're an alcoholic, to me. And my wife and I looked at each other and said, this guy is insane. I mean, we went home and drank that night and talked about how crazy he was. Now, but this guy wasn't in recovery, but he started to talk about progression, disease, talked about the book, talked about meetings. He gave me so he said, do me a favor, don't drink for the month of October. I was in sufficient trouble at home to pull that off. He didn't say go to a meeting. He didn't say permanent. He said don't drink for the month. I did that. Then in November, he said, why don't you try a two-drink maximum month? That was the single hardest thing in the world. Complete failure. Couldn't do it. So, and all the while, he's talking about recovery and the disease, and it's starting to come in. So I'm getting the trouble off my back, so I'm getting what I want, and I'm doing these things, and the two-drink maximum was awful. I couldn't do it. So he gave me a guy's phone number, said, this guy's in AA, call him. I said, right. I kept it for some reason. I get this problem going away. We get into this sort of holidays. I get all the problems off, and I think I've got this under control. Then a random night in February of 2004, I remember looking at my daughter, said, I'll be home at 10. The next morning, I walked in about 10, and my wife's look was not, you're a jerk. It wasn't pity, it was sadness. I mean, a pity sadness. It was just like, yeah. And so I said, I'm done. I don't know where that came from. Honestly, I knew I was done. So I found that guy's number. I called it. He said, meet me at Lenox Hill on Monday night at 6:45 on the steps. So I showed up at 6:45. He said, tell everybody I'm your temporary sponsor. I know nothing about recovery. I thought all you did was not drink for an hour in here. So I walk in, and I sit next to him, and the guy speaks. Dick was there. And a guy tells a story, and when they say, is anybody new, I raise my hand and said, I'm Clark, and I have one day. And, you know, I haven't had a drink since. I can't explain that other than the collective part of recovery. I have not been perfect, but I've done that perfectly. I almost lost my marriage at year 5 by not knowing what emotional sobriety meant. I heard a woman say in a meeting, if you're not careful with recovery, you'll have lower bottoms in recovery than you did drinking, and I experienced it, but I didn't drink. What that did was I met Dick, who's my sponsor, and it changed everything because I started to work on the recovery that was more than alcohol. And the alcohol, I heard well put one time, that it's like a big piece of paper where you put your finger and thumb over the corner and that's alcohol and the rest is the disease. And so Dick has kindly, for the last 10 years, taken me through talking about the disease. And, you know, I can now say more than I'm good or bad, or I'm happy or sad, or everything's fine. I have some ability to recognize the what's really going on. I mean, I like to think about it now is that, you know, I'm still insane. It's a disease of the mind. I wake up every day completely crazy. My visual is I have the 7 deadly sins, pride, anger, greed, gluttony, lust, envy, sloth, in the start of the Kentucky Derby. They're in the gate. The bell goes off, and they're running. And all of a sudden, it's like, there goes pride under control. But, you know, envy and sloth are over here in a fight. And so on a daily basis, I have a chance to try to grab one back, say, that's not right, to try to equalize it, to call my sponsor. You know, I had no idea that, I mean, I read about the 7 deadly sins, but I never internalized it. All the stuff is in the literature. The first time I read it, I didn't understand anything. One of the greatest things that has happened with working with Dick is we read the literature page to page, looking at each other across a table. That changed a lot of my recovery. I currently had a moment of honesty, which I met Dick. I said, things weren't that good. And he said, well, let's talk about that. After talking about it, he suggested doing work, like, oh my God, like, you know, pick up the literature and let's get after it. So I did the 10-step work, and it actually helped a great deal. Surprise, surprise. You know, when the pain is so great, sometimes I don't, it takes a lot for me to get there. You know, I'm the guy that needs to jump into a fire to know that it's hot. You can tell me it's hot all day long, too, but I'll have to experience it for myself. And, you know, AA has not let me down. I've learned a lot. I go to a lot of meetings. I go to Citigroup a lot right now at lunchtime. It suits my schedule. It's near my office. It's a pretty energetic group. A lot of support. I've been here before. I started at Lenox Hill. I did the Upper East Side Shuffle for a while. the Metropolitan Chapter 5 Fearless Deal. And I've been all over the city, and we're very fortunate in the city, obviously, to have so much recovery. So today, it's pretty amazing. You know, when we dig our bottoms, we dig until we're done. I dug until I was 40. I don't really know why I came in. I knew I wanted the pain to go away. I was miserable. I didn't know recovery was going to do it, but I took a chance. I had a moment, and it worked. Now, the recovery part is also progressive. So when I stand here, this is the beyond your wildest dreams stuff. Like, I never thought in a million years I'd be standing in a group like this that I hold with a great deal of esteem to tell my story. Because I'd be like, I'm not good enough. Nobody wants to hear me. The lies start. The horses are going. I mean, that's what that is. My fear is a result of those guys being threatened in a lot of ways. And so, you know, for today, I'm still married. It's amazing. It's gotten a lot better. I have three wonderful kids. I get to, you know, be a sober parent, which just means that they can count on me a way that they used to not be able to, even though my son really didn't know. But my daughters, you know, so far are so good. I mean, they have their own path. But, you know, we're very close, and I know the community well of AA. I spend a lot of time in it. I talk to a lot of sober people. My sponsee is here who takes the program very seriously, as do I. I think the suggestions are poorly worded. You know, I believe that they should be taken like with that life raft and held upon because it's that serious. I take this life or death. I was jail, death, or a mental institution, 100%. I don't debate the program. I accept the program. The faith, I was somewhat lucky. I had one, so it wasn't foreign, but I just believe it was written so openly that we have an ability to just know it in me. So as far as, you know, I'm very fortunate. Since I was serious, I was a serious alcoholic. I'm the real deal they write about. I was going 1,000 miles an hour into a brick wall. No question. I jumped off a little early. I saw the wreck happening. I remember when I went in to tell the guy that owned my company I was getting sober, he said, well, you should go to rehab. And I said, I walked out of there and I was like, how insulting is that guy? Rehab? Do you know who I am? Mr. Big Shot, as they say. But I didn't go into rehab. I walked into AA. My sponsor and I like to joke about it that I was a walk-on and not a scholarship athlete. But, you know, I love that everybody has their own path, but we have a single purpose. We're here to help each other. And I know some of the people in this room, but what I know about this room is how seriously you take the disease and the recovery. I respect it fully because I think it does get a little soft these days. And I know if you do the work, the results come because I'm evidence of it. I don't know what the magic piece is, but I'll do it all so I don't miss it. And, you know, it's just, I learned it early. I got really lucky. Stick with the winners. Go find what you want. You know, all those suggestions. And you learn it over time, obviously. So, you know, for me, it's great to be at the Atlantic Group. This is an awesome group. You do a lot for people. And I hope everybody has a good night. Thank you.